I'm Tom Rowan. You're listening to the second hour of Free 103.9's Turn on the News, a weekly look at radio art, radio news, media news, and more. You can go to newsroom.free103.9.org or free103.9.org for all sorts of links to more about transmission art, radio news, and media news. And you can tune in, Turn on the News, daily on Free 103.9.
what you say. I don't wanna, I don't think so. I don't wanna, I don't think so.
You're listening to Turn on the News. That's Sonic Youth, and Sonic Youth's gonna stay with us a minute. Pendulum behind us. So as we talk about the Elrod Corporation, and it's Elrod Sound Cannon, Elrad, A-L-R-A-D Sound Cannon, the Elrod Corporation makes. They have a new Elrod 2000X military grade that can transmit voice commands at up to 162 decibels up to 5.5 miles away. We're talking about sonic weapons now, and the Elrod Corporation makes a 500X model, too. It's designed to 2,000 meters and can be heard for 650 meters away. It's capable of short bursts of directive sound that cause severe headaches in anyone within a 300-meter range. Anyone within 15 meters of the device's audio path can experience permanent hearing loss. Elrod claims the device is not a weapon, but a, quote, directed sound communication device. A directed sound communication device. A directed sound communication device. A directed sound communication device. Elrod systems are deployed at airports to sonically deter birds from residing in the paths of aircraft. This is from Gizmodo.com. Excuse me. And the Elrod has been used several times on Americans, by Americans. Usually the Americans that it's been used against have been protesting something or have been angry with the government about some law or perceived inadequacy in the law, otherwise known as democracy. The first documented use was in Pittsburgh during the G20 summit in 2009. Pittsburgh police used it again following the Super Bowl in 2011. The Elrod has reportedly been used against Occupy protesters in Oakland and recently against Occupy Wall Street protesters in Zuccotti Park. Use of the device has come under fire because of the potential for permanent hearing loss. Human discomfort starts when a sound hits 120 decibels and below the Elrod's threshold. Permanent hearing loss begins at 130 decibels, and if the device is turned up to 140 decibels, anyone within its path would not only suffer hearing loss, they could potentially lose their balance and be unable to move out of the path of the audio. The device is also entirely operator-dependent, which could lead to serious ramifications if the officer in charge doesn't have sufficient training. Let's go to CBS, and they've got a report here.
David Martin was among the first to report on the Pentagon's ray gun. It's a high-tech weapon that does not kill. It seemed ideal for controlling mobs, but it's never been used. And we asked David to find out why.
Call it Ray Gun 2.0, a new and improved version of a weapon we first told you about 4 years ago. That flat dish antenna fired very high frequency radio waves that stopped a person in his tracks without killing or even injuring him. It caused a burning sensation that made you instantly jump out of the way. The Pentagon has been demonstrating how it can control an angry crowd menacing a U.S. checkpoint without having to resort to deadly force. Officially called the active denial system, it's been tested on humans 11,000 times.
Bring it on!
Once on then Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, Sue Payton, who touted it as the solution to the accidental killing of Iraqi civilians by American troops.
Huge breakthrough, huge game changer.
Would this save lives in Iraq?
It would save huge numbers of lives.
But the ray gun never made it to Iraq. As the program manager at the time, Colonel Kirk Himes, told us, military commanders have a hard time trusting a weapon that doesn't kill.
If this system could kill people, it would be easier to field.
Lethal weapons have an easier time getting into our system.
In 2010, the ray gun was shipped to Afghanistan, where prevention of civilian casualties is seen as key to success. But it was sent right back because American commanders were afraid the Afghan people would see it as a torture device or a plot to sterilize Afghan men. The current program manager, Colonel Tracy Tafola, is trying again to send it to Afghanistan, but it remains a tough sell.
Can't see it, can't hear it, can't smell it, and it's kind of hard to get, I think, your arms around that for a lot of people.
It still works the same way, but it's supposed to be even safer because the beam automatically shuts off in 3 seconds.
It's been in development for 18 years and cost $120 million. But until a battlefield commander is willing to trust it, the ray gun will remain a military sideshow. David Martin, CBS News, Quantico, Virginia.
All right, this is Tom Rowe with Free 103.9. In 2004, the New York police were geared up to use the LRAD against protesters at the Republican National Convention, and Captain Kitten made this radio play about the LRAD weapon for Free 103.9.
Where they're allowed to march. Earlier this year, manufacturer American Technology Corporation of San Diego won a $1.1 million contract from the U.S. Marine Corps, which used these gadgets in Iraq. The military builds the long-range acoustic device as a non-lethal weapon, designed to disperse hostile crowds or ward off potential foreign combatants by delivering pre-recorded warnings in several languages, communicating important messages, and, if needed, a blast of ear-splitting feedback.
There are also remote control airplanes and helicopters doing more than delivering tacos these days, and the military is waging war in Afghanistan largely by remote control.
The mission of the Reaper is both ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and also CAS, close air support. So not only are we helping ground forces see what they need to see, but if they're in trouble, we have weapons that can support suppressing the enemy forces. We really don't have to fly that high not to be seen. One, because they're not that large, and two, because it's not that loud. It's really amazing. And there's two stations. There's the pilot station and the sensor station. The pilot obviously is controlling the aircraft and the movement of the aircraft, whereas the sensor is controlling the sensor ball and actually moving that to look at different things, zoom in, zoom out. Our video feed is literally being watched by people all over the country and the world. There's people down on the ground really relying on you getting the best picture of whatever they need you to look at. We have the ability to stay airborne for 24-hour periods and tie all these different people into the scene and make decisions very promptly. We're able to have more troops here at home, but at the same time having as much of an impact on getting the mission done overseas.
The MQ-9 Reaper aircraft is capable of carrying 4 Hellfire munitions. The Reaper is also capable of carrying 4 GBU munitions, guided bomb units. We can either load the GBU-12. The GBU-12 is a 500-pound laser-guided munition, or the GBU-38, which is a GPS-guided munition. The Hellfire is extremely accurate, and it's laser-guided. The sensor operator, they're the ones that lays the target. The sensor can pick where they want to put the munition, whether in a car window, the passenger, or the rear. They work in coordination with the pilot. He's the one that actually pulls the trigger, releasing the weapon. It's amazing to see these munitions at work. It's very satisfying to know that we have a hand in what's going on in the world, whether it's training pilots' home station or being deployed, supporting the war effort.
Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, a strategic and tactical methodology developed under military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. It was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling a society. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its manner of functioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. The silent weapon makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet, it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life, i.e., unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon, and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great, and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobilities of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. Repetition, 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 repetition breeds suggestibility. Repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not suggestible. I am not suggestible. I am not open to suggestion. Repetition, repetition, repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not open to suggestion. Repetition breeds suggestibility. Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon. It was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same words might be useful for totally controlling a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking by knowing. Understanding, manipulating, and attacking by knowing. Understanding, manipulating, and attacking by knowing. Understanding, manipulating, and attacking. Repetition breeds suggestibility. It shoots situations instead of bullets. Propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction. Originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder. From a computer instead of a gun. Operated by a computer programmer instead of a horseman. Under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. By knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking. By knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking. By knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking. Understanding, manipulating, and attacking. Repetition, suggestibility. Repetition, suggestibility. Repetition, suggestibility. Repetition, suggestibility. Repetition reads suggestibility.
March 28th, day in radio history. In 1924, WGN-AM Chicago, Illinois, went on the air. In 1985, Belgian radio host, TV host Nand Burt died at age 53. And this day, in 1986, over 6,000 radio stations in the United States played the song We Are the World at exactly 10:15 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Finally, in 1964, Radio Caroline, the legendary offshore pirate radio station, which began to broadcast, off the coast of England, on March 28, 1964, they did some tests on March 27th, and March 28th was the first, I think, official Radio Caroline broadcast day. When we come back on Turn on the News, we will talk more about Radio Caroline and delve into the history. And here some audio clips and some radio art made from audio clips from Radio Caroline on Turn on the News.
Caroline, you break my heart. I will. bring them back once they have gone. Oh, Carolina.
So March 28th is, the anniversary of the day in 1964 when Radio Caroline went on the air for the first time. We are going to hear some audio clips from Radio Caroline, some reporting later, and some interviews with the folks that begat that station. It's also coincidentally Tom Lodge, one of the Radio Caroline's original DJs, has died this week in 2012. He was born in 1936. He died at his home in California after a long illness, which the Radio Caroline website says he refused conventional treatment. So we're telling a little bit about his story and the story of Radio Caroline. Tom Lodge joined the Canadian Broadcasting Company first. And he met Ronan O'Rahilly, who is the main founder of Radio Caroline, and asked him, and that's how he got involved as a DJ and then program director, and led Caroline South. There was a Caroline North. There was a Caroline South. We'll go to Wikipedia just for the little introduction. Radio Caroline was begun by Irish musician, manager, and businessman Ronan O'Rahilly. O'Rahilly failed to obtain airplay on Radio Luxembourg for Georgie Fame's records because its airtime was committed to sponsored programmings. So he was basically starting his own record label and wanted airplay, and so he started a radio station to get his own airplay. That's the story. And the story at the time, too, is the BBC. They limited pop music severely and was not airing anything. So there was a definite need, too. Let's hear this little overview of Radio Caroline.
Wherever you looked in 66, there were people challenging the status quo. Far out in the North Sea, a broadcasting revolution was taking place. It was led by a group of disc jockeys who wanted to break the BBC's monopoly of the airwaves. Some of them are still going strong today.
It's hard to visualize 40 years ago what radio was like in this country. We had, prior to that, the BBC operating the Home Service, the Light Programme and Third Programme. Not a lot of pop music on those channels. And at night time there was Radio Luxembourg, where you could listen under the bedclothes to a crystal set or an old valve radio set.
All that changed when the first pirate, Radio Caroline, was launched in 1964. It revolutionized radio in this country by playing pop music around the clock. By 1966, the number of rivals was growing all the time.
Later this week, yet another pirate will be anchored here off Harwich. Under the call sign of Swinging Radio England, this most powerful and largest of the pirates will go on the air round the clock in a bid to scuttle her rivals.
Whilst one new vessel was being launched, another was temporarily taken out of service in 1966. Caroline ran aground in winter storms near Frinton. Ironically, transistor radios had been banned from the beach the previous summer. Now they had the country's most popular radio station taking up valuable sandcastle space.
And within minutes, the rescue parties, including the police, arrived on the scene, and the DJs, the engineers, all came onto the beach courtesy of Breech's boy. And then they were, should we say, escorted down to the local nick. Hello, hello, hello. What are we doing here?
The great adventure ended a year later with a government bill banning the pirates. None of the DJs ended up with criminal records, although some of them have played a few since.
Here's some artwork now. Neurotransmitters Chronicle remixing early Radio Caroline recordings.
1, 2, 2. 1, 2, 2. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3.
This is Radio Caroline on 199. The time is 12 o'clock.
I'm afraid the clock has beaten us. It's 10 o'clock again.
1, 2, 3, and the time is 17 past the hour of 10 o'clock.
It is now exactly 10 o'clock, Bulova watch time. BULOVA Bulova.
We have got reports from as far back as, far away rather, as New Zealand and Australia. You can actually hear it there. Won't be very good, of course, but...
The weather, the sun which came out over the south of England this afternoon, just despite the forecasters, should keep the skies clear until later this evening when clouds will appear.
Good morning to you, ladies and gentlemen. This is Radio Caroline, broadcasting on 199 meters in the medium wave band. We're broadcasting from the radio ship, the Mi Amigo.
You're tuned to 199, Radio Caroline, your all-day music station. The time, 1 minute past 11, and time to Senator Carl Conway.
Chicago, Dr. Martin Luther King has cancelled a protest march planned for tomorrow. In South Africa and Rhodesia, ministers have issued strong warnings to would-be terrorists. In New Zealand, the British rugby team has been beaten by 19 points to 6. And in London, the General Secretary of the TUC, Mr. George Woodcock, is in hospital with a slight heart attack.
Right, you are. Well, if you're having tea now, it's 12 past 5 o'clock, or if you're going to eat at 6 o'clock, then you've got, 48 minutes to go before tea time.
I don't know what the weather's like where you are. It's calmed down a bit from what it was last night, but we still have a bit of a swell going for us at the moment. I've just been up on deck, you know, thought it might be good policy to get us over there before I came on the air. And the sea is very calm indeed, you know, and yet the boat is rocking a bit. This is one of these peculiar things about being at sea, you know, you get a, what's called a side swell. It means the waves come at the side of the boat. And the boat can be rocking like anything, but the weather be quite nice. It isn't sunny yet, there's a sea fog. The skipper is going to move our boat just a little bit, more inland, and see if we can get a better result. So if you hear the engines running during the morning, that's what it is.
Australia. Sir Francis Chichester has run into rough conditions in the Tasman Sea. Several hundred miles north of his position, there is a fierce cyclone that is causing strong winds and making the sea rough. China. Following an incident at the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in which a window was smashed, Chinese members of the staff at the Yugoslav embassy in Peking have gone on strike in protest of the incident. America. It's been announced that since the 1950s, America's arms sales to foreign countries have increased by 600%. Last year's sales had a value of over £700 million. As a result of the American sales, Britain can't even sell enough arms to Germany to offset the cost of the Rhine Army. Russia. As a result of the present anti-Russian attitude taken by the Chinese, the Russians have complained over the recent rioting outside their embassy in Peking. They've also protested over the treatment of their embassy staff. London. Last night, a man was shot outside a public house in the St. Pancras area. The incident occurred after a political argument in the pub between communists and fascists. The man was taken to hospital where he was operated on. His condition is said to be satisfactory.
Caroline North, national and international, now leaves the air to resume broadcasting at 5:45 a.m. tomorrow morning. We broadcast from studios on board the good ship MV Caroline, which is laying at anchor in international waters, 3.5 miles off the Bay of Ramsey in the wonderful Isle of Man. Radio Caroline broadcasts on a frequency of 1169 kilocycles, 259 meters in the medium wave band.
All right, Radio Caroline is our subject. That was Neurotransmitter with their Chronicle, a 5-minute take on Radio Caroline audio archives, remixed with some sounds of waves and all. The interesting note about Radio Caroline is they got its name from Carolyn Kennedy, daughter of U.S. President John F. Kennedy. Apparently, there's a famous Life magazine photograph of the Kennedy children in the Oval Office. Carolyn Kennedy was playing in Ronan O'Rahilly believed she was disrupting the business of government, and that was the image he wanted for his station. And that's how Radio Caroline became to be known as Radio Caroline. This is from the soundtrack to the movie Pirate Radio that came out a few years ago. Philip Seymour Hoffman and others in it was based on the Radio Caroline story. Here's another interview with the founders of Radio Caroline. This is from 1989, after the station had, been knocked off the air numerous times and gotten back on. The ship sunk. Ship had been towed for lack of payment of some sort, but the English broadcasting authorities still had this pesky pirate radio station off its coast that it couldn't really do anything about.
Caroline's beginning was as a direct result of me managing an artist called Georgie Fame, and at the time, and both EMI and Decca turned him down, and the only alternative was to start a label. But in order to start a label, you had to have a radio station promote it, and then I kept getting back to a radio station, and that's how, that was the motivation for doing it.
Radio Caroline was originally based on the Mi Amigo, where many household names started their careers, including the BBC's Johnny Walker.
Johnny, when you were working for Radio Caroline, what made it unique?
Well, it was there'd never been anything like it before. And there hasn't since, really. That was the beauty of it. And it's the only radio situation I've ever been in where, A, the bosses aren't around, they're in London, and if you do something a bit outrageous that they object to, there's nothing they can do about it. I mean, if you really went over the top, as I did one night at about 11 o'clock, they tried to hire a special boat to go out to Caroline to have you taken off. But fortunately, all of the guys who sailed the boats were in the pub at the time, so none of them fancied a late-night trip.
Before we go any further, what exactly did you do that night?
I was only trying to help the BBC, because I'd read Mrs. Dow's diary, was the audience figures were suffering, you see. So I thought, well, if we put them on Caroline, A, we'll bring them to a whole new audience, and B, they'll all have been guilty of breaking the Marine Offences Act and liable to 2 years in jail. So I thought it'd be rather interesting. You know, I'm worried about Jimmy's in the nick. So I said it was by a special link with the BBC, and I just had a transistor radio with an earphone, and I just was listening to it in one ear and doing the show with the other. And then as soon as the Dales theme started, I said, now by a special link with the BBC in London, Mrs. Dow's diary, and just held this radio up against the mic. And the quality was great, sounded beautiful.
Were there any special acts that Caroline championed?
You'd have to draw the list up of who we didn't. I remember the Animals' House of the Rising Sun was a 6-minute record, which the BBC, bless them, couldn't cope with, the idea of fitting a 6-minute single in Pick of the Pops. So the Animals definitely were helped a lot. The Rolling Stones were, the Moody Blues. Most of the bands who came through in the mid-60s will tell you that they owe it to the pilot stations.
out of their frequency and into my head. They told me who I was. They were three small men. They were three small men.
In his inaugural address at the second meeting of the Italian Society for the Advancement of Science on September 11, 1930, Marconi expressed his belief that radio waves may travel long distances, even millions of miles beyond the Earth's atmospheric layer. According to Marconi, radio waves go to outer space.
Rode an invisible wave, but they weren't nothing like a rolling ball. They just kept walking until they found their way home. They were chewing on carbon, they were built to the core. That radio was fine, but that radio sore.
A stone thrown into a pond causes ripples or waves on the surface of the water, which move away from the point of disturbance in concentric circles of ever-increasing diameters until they reach the shore.
What happened to the three small men? Well, I've got one right here, and another one right here. They're right where I left them, right where they're found. Because we're all trapped into concealment, and we're all trapped by a bit of sound. Sound crawling into me, a bit of sound crawling into me, a bit of sound crawling into me.
He would grow up to feel at home in both Italian and British cultures. In his childhood home, Villa Grifoni, near Bologna, Italy, young Marconi developed an ardent interest in science and read widely, including the papers of Heinrich Hertz, a German physicist who experimented with electromagnetic waves. Marconi lived in a time when wires carried telegraph messages, yet such wires could not be laid over vast stretches of land and sea. Ships could not be warned of bad weather, nor could they signal for help. Marconi imagined, what if electromagnetic waves, without the necessity of wires, could carry a long-distance message through the air? What if the power of radio waves could reach ships far from shore? In his attic, Marconi built a battery-powered transmitter, and in 1894, he sent the taps of the Morse code across his father's estate, a distance of over 1 mile. But in his native Italy, he found little appreciation for his invention. So, at the age of 22, he sailed to England, a nation deeply invested in maritime interests. He quickly patented his black box, and in 1896, he formed the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Company, later renamed the Marconi Company. In Britain, a monopoly controlled all land-based commercial message handling, so...
You're listening to Turn on the News. Little Marconi there for the anniversary of the 1899 broadcast from France to England. Now we're going to a different anniversary. Freeway 3.9's 15th anniversary is this March 2012, and we've been celebrating all month with some audio archives. Next up is a report from the Columbia Radio News from Greg Clark about micro radio, and it includes some 3.1 to 3.9 audio. So stay tuned.
If you happen to be tuning around your FM dial in Williamsburg, Brooklyn on Saturday afternoon 2 weeks ago, you may have heard this. Just between 103.5 WKTU and Q104, New York's only classic rock.
Throw your head in the air and play me like you just don't care. The party's over here. Oh, 103.9 FM!
The budding MC calls herself Destiny. She is one of a dozen 9, 10, and 11-year-old radio enthusiasts from Harlem who have come on a field trip to visit one of New York's pirate radio stations. They're here at 103.9 FM to produce their very own broadcast. For about 3 hours, the rambunctious youngsters talk and shout, play tape-recorded interviews they have conducted, and take turns announcing their favorite songs.
How y'all doing out there? All right, we're going to play the Rugrats tape. And I hope y'all enjoy this song. Give a shout-out to my family, my friends, and God.
Free 103.9 broadcasts from a 40-watt transmitter and a rooftop antenna. Compared to the 50,000-watt transmitters of many commercial stations, the signal is so low it's called micropower. But the broadcast reaches radios within a few miles. For more than a year, these children have been learning about radio at an after-school program at the housing projects where most of them live. The group is even setting up their own half-watt transmitter that will broadcast to their neighborhood. They call it WKDR, Kids Discover Radio. Pilar Alamo teaches the radio class.
I think this is a great motivation for them. You know, I write contracts with them where in order to borrow the equipment, they have to read me back the contract and sign it. Kids that usually don't read, they're reading that contract like crazy because they want to take the equipment home and, you know.
Alamo says the goal of the radio project is to empower community members, starting with the children, to tell their own stories in their own voices. The drawback is that these radio broadcasts are illegal. Neither Free 103.9 nor WJMZ have a license, and the Federal Communications Commission, which regulates all broadcasting in the United States, does not license micropower radio. When Congress established the FCC in 1934, it recognized the airwaves as public property, but it also recognized them as a scarce resource that needed to be controlled. Otherwise, the broadcast spectrum would become so cluttered that nobody would be able to use it. So Congress charged the FCC to regulate the airwaves and to do so in the public interest. The commission has jurisdiction over every kind of broadcast, from TV and radio to airline and nautical transmissions to cellular telephones, and it vigorously cracks down on unlicensed broadcasters. During the past year and a half, the FCC has shut down more than 475 pirate radio stations across the country. David Fisk is a spokesman for the FCC.
That system only works if everybody has an allocated, you know, slot to use and stays within that slot. The whole purpose is to prevent interference.
Free 103.9.
On Saturday night after the children have left, DJ Dizzy takes to the air. He says he understands the FCC's concerns, but he has been careful to select a frequency and a signal strength that does not interfere with legal stations or other pirates. But he still moves around a lot, playing a cat-and-mouse game with the FCC.
We don't broadcast from a regular position. We don't broadcast on any sort of regular schedule. And we try to just let the people that can tune in know about it.
While the program is music tonight, the station will try anything.
People do radio plays. There's been call-in shows. We had a party on top of the Williamsburg Bridge one night. All these DJs played on top of the bridge.
Dizzy envisions 30 antennas in the area, with different neighborhood groups sharing the same transmitter on a rotating basis. The station might broadcast a block party one week, air Hasidic programming the next, and Latin after that. He sees broadcasting as an act of civil disobedience, in which the people who own the airwaves are reclaiming them in the public interest. He says the FCC is only protecting the commercial exploitation of the public's airwaves.
The airwaves are this like natural resource, like parkland or something that's been devastated by commercial development. I mean, it's like if all the parks in the country had factories on them by these people making their own private money.
Recently, there are signs that the FCC is listening to these and similar arguments. In January, the commission proposed granting new 1,000-watt and 100-watt licenses. FCC spokesman David Fisk.
The idea was that if you could find spaces where you're broadcasting with lower power, then you wouldn't be causing interference with some of the large stations, but you'd enable either a church or a community group or an ethnic group or a college or even a high school could have a short-range broadcasting going, you know, to a particular narrowly defined community in a short area.
But those who already own broadcast licenses don't buy that argument. They say sticking a whole lot of small stations in the radio band would interfere with the already established stations. This is the position of the National Association of Broadcasters, which opposes the FCC's low-power proposal. While pirate operators believe that a plethora of micropower stations is the answer, they also oppose the FCC's low-power proposal. When FCC Chairman William Kennard visited New York last month, about 20 supporters of micro-broadcasting rallied outside the New York Law School, where Kennard delivered a speech. They carried signs that read, "FCC don't stomp on me," and "Micropower to the people." About half the protesters were involved with Steal This Radio, a pirate station for Manhattan's Lower East Side. The activists argue that the 1,000-watt and 100-watt licenses being proposed are still too powerful for most community radio purposes. Michael Eisenanger was one of the demonstrators. He says granting new low-power licenses won't change a thing if the licenses are simply sold to more commercial stations.
We have all sorts of mass media, you know, that we can go to for the corporate or the commercial message. Broadcast really lends itself to, you know, local people talking about local issues.
Until last week, another pirate station was broadcasting in Williamsburg.
WJFZ 89.3, this is Buddha Princess.
WJMZ was on the air three nights a week, broadcasting everything from Latin music to live techno to community activism. The Buddha Princess's Tea Party was on the air every Monday night. Half the show was about sex and the other half about city politics. Tonight, the host and her guest talk about plans to auction off community gardens and the mayor's efforts to enforce an obscure anti-dancing ordinance in New York nightclubs.
Join us as we create a liberated dance zone by forming the world's largest hokey-pokey around City Hall to protest Herr Giuliani's crackdown on unauthorized dance.
Just a week after this program aired, and a few days after the Hokey Pokey protest, the FCC shut down WJMZ. Field engineers from the FCC's New York office found the station's studios last Tuesday, and they threatened to fine the pirate operators and seize their equipment if the station didn't cease broadcasting. The FCC will be accepting public comment about its proposal to license low-power stations until June 1st. But the commission made clear that low-power licensing is not an effort to legalize pirate stations. In some cases, pirates who have continued to defy FCC regulations will be banned from applying for low-power licenses. If it's decided that low-power is the way to go, changes could be announced by the end of the year. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Greg Clark.
Next on Turn on the News, we have the story of a monkey who works at a radio station and then gets his own television show.